Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. It's been a challenging year for Portland and just about every other city in this country. As we head into a new year, what can be done to make the city less dysfunctional and a healthier and more equitable place for everyone to live? Today we talk with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about the specific challenges that Portland City government and its citizens face as we deal with some harsh realizations about the roots of what seems to have gone so wrong, as well as what is actually going quite well. Joanne, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be back here with you, Barbara.
And we miss you at KABU. You know, we're actually doing some shows live at KABU now, and I was kind of hoping you'd come into the station, but I understand why you're not.
Yes. We are still in COVID time, so all safety precautions are absolutely necessary, but I so miss KABU. As you know, I almost had it figured out until March 2020 happened, and now we are where we are.
Actually, I think that KABU is one of the safer places I'm spending time in during COVID, because when I'm there, it's me, Ray the engineer, and whoever my guest is, and the place is the cleanest it's been in years.
What?
And I hope that after the pandemic is over, these are some of the lessons that we learn.
Yes, I'm glad to hear that.
Well, today is January 6th. We're recording this on January 6th. So, Joanne, I wanted to start by just talking about the context of what this day means and how a year ago has shaped so much of what we're experiencing now.
Well, what a very compelling question, Barbara, because you're right. When I woke up this morning, I thought about where I was, and I was actually sitting right at the same computer, involved in a meeting when I started hearing about this takeover of the U.S. Capitol. It was absolutely terrifying. It was absolutely, I did not know how it was going to end, right? I just thought that this is a day I never thought I would see in my lifetime for so, so many reasons. And of course, we've learned a lot more since then. Over the last year, we've had a lot of experiences that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, like the federal government actually attacking civilians in our local community. And so I can't think of January 6th without thinking about what happened on the streets in Portland 6 months before that, because having a federal government that was out of control and just terrorizing Portlanders based on a national narrative that, quite frankly, just simply wasn't true. I didn't think in my lifetime I would see white supremacists so arrogantly, so boldly, so vocally on our streets, on our airwaves, in our institutions, so vocally opposed to this government. So a lot has happened in the last year that makes you realize that the United States democracy is really at risk. And the question is, how do we protect our democracy? Which is why Portlanders took to the street every single night, right? It was about, this is our democracy, and people don't get to come in and just disrupt it in this way, right? We've all had experiences of elections where we liked the results and we didn't. But we have never actually stormed the Capitol to demand some outrageous outcome.
I've thought a lot as I was watching it happen and then looking at all that footage that you saw over and over and over again after the fact about how many demonstrations I participated in at the Capitol and the Pentagon, starting back when I was 18 in 1967. And yet, you know, we probably had the fantasy of shutting down the government, but not doing it like that. And I kind of want to distinguish that, because one of the things that has been talked a lot in the past week leading up to today is how the right is still trying to blame this on, quote, Antifa, whatever that really is. And yet, even Antifa, which is a more of a violent edge part of the left, I think is far from having even conceived of doing what happened. So let's talk about the difference between what the left would have done and what happened.
Well, let me just say, if Black Lives Matter protesters were known to be coming to the U.S. Capitol, they would not have gotten anywhere near the doors. There would have been the appropriate security mechanisms in place to ensure that people didn't get that they did not put the U.S. Capitol at risk, right? I mean, I've been to D.C. a bazillion times, and the amount of security in D.C. on a normal day, not a day where you're expecting anything abnormal, is enormous, right? I mean, I don't even know the number of police forces that operate there, but it's significant, right? You can't go anywhere without facing really well-armed security in D.C. And so I found it just inexcusable that it was allowed, that security was denied, it wasn't requested. When it was offered, it was refused. That situation would have even happened. I mean, we have intelligence agents, right, that say Black Lives Matter protesters are terrorist-type organizations, but we don't do the same kind of scrutiny of white supremacy and white nationalist-type organizations. But they have been terrorizing Portland ever since 45 was in office. I mean, they were here before then, but they were not as vocal and bold as they are today.
Well, I was thinking about how a lot of people are saying, you know, remembering what you were doing when you heard about the Capitol insurrection a year ago. And I was sitting right here interviewing a woman named Samantha Kropp, who was an expert on spotted owls. And we were talking happily about, you know, protecting spotted owls.
Right, right.
And were clueless about what was going on. And then I went upstairs and was listening to the radio and was like, what is going on? And to me, that was a real shift in terms of my focus, which is a lot environmental issues, suddenly realizing that we'll be in the same position as the spotted owls if this insurrection continues.
Well, I mean, look at what happened leading up to the elections. Who would have ever thought that there would be an organized effort to remove mailboxes in communities to make it as difficult as possible for community members to vote? And we tend to forget that regardless of whether Democrats or Republicans are in office, Black people today still stand in line on average 5 to 6 hours, having to take off from work and standing in really severe conditions all over the United States of America for the privilege to vote, right? And what I find is we continue to miss opportunities to fundamentally be who we say we are, right? When the U.S. Supreme Court changed the Voting Rights Act, Democrats controlled both houses in the presidency, and they did absolutely nothing, right? So there was an opportunity for us to actually believe in our democracy and make sure that what 45 did couldn't have happened, right? So, to me, it is not a partisan issue when you talk about what is democracy, right? And who has access to democracy and whose voice should be heard? I think we don't do a good job of that anywhere. And it's really clear and what the outcomes are, right? But when you start removing mailboxes, when you start removing early voting, when you start trying to penalize people for voting, and when you try to make people afraid to actually go and actually make their voice heard, that's when democracy is eroded, right? And so we've been eroding our democracy for a while through actions and inactions. And all of a sudden, we've got this window where white nationalists have really shifted both the public psyche and the solutions that we seem to be talking about publicly.
Well, before we started recording, we both talked about wanting to try to be as positive as possible.
Yes. But that's where we were.
Yesterday, I got an email from Stacey Abrams, one of my favorite people.
One of mine,
reminding us that yesterday was a day of an anniversary of celebration, because that's when Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff were both elected to the Senate from Georgia.
That's right.
Stacey Abrams is still at it. And I just wonder, even though we're not seeing much action happening from the federal government in terms of voting rights, I mean, the Democrats are trying, but there's some big obstacles.
The Democrats try when it's convenient, right? The Democrats could have fixed this problem. What I'm saying is it wouldn't be a problem had the Democrats fixed it when they had the power to do so.
How much faith do you have that Stacey Abrams, who pulled off such a miracle a year ago in Georgia and who's now going to be running for governor next year, do you think that she has, and the forces behind her, have the ability to overcome all the stresses on democracy that you've been describing?
Well, you know, Stacey Abrams is one of my sheroes. I mean, here's a woman who, for all intents and purposes, had an election stolen from her. And she could have just taken her ball and gone home and said, "The heck with you people, you don't deserve me." And instead, what she did was decided she was going to organize voters, and she was going to make sure she was going to galvanize people all over Georgia to turn out so that we could actually have Democratic gains in Georgia, as well as actually take back the presidency. She has done everything she has ever said she would do and then some, so she's my hero. And she's right? There are great things. Actually, I was reminded by Facebook. I was just sworn in fact, this week, 3 years ago. And I am celebrating my anniversary of being the first Black woman on the Portland City Council, right? So there are absolutely fabulous things that are happening. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge the big picture and then say, okay, so what are we doing here locally? Because I think there's a big missing piece. And the big missing piece for me is around healing. We have not had an opportunity since March of 2020, in between crises after crises after crises, to actually take a moment to heal. And as a community, when you're just being bombarded with negative after negative after negative, it really does have start having an impact on your psyche, especially when every time you walk out your door, what you see is suffering, right? You see, and you're fearful, right? We have high levels of gun violence, right? But what we don't have is a strategy of how are we gonna impact gun violence across the spectrum, right? We know domestic violence is up. We know suicide is up. We know stranger violence is up, right? Because we know people are economically devastated, and many people are facing desperate situations, right? So I think taking a moment to breathe and to appreciate, because here's one of the things that I have seen since March of 2020, the type of community mutual aid that I've seen has surpassed like the 60s, like 500 time folds. People are taking care of each other. People are taking care of their neighbors. They're checking in on the elderly. They're bringing food to houseless camps in ways that are very compassionate, empathetic, and really understanding that if we're gonna get out of this COVID reality that we've been living in, that we in fact have to, we have to help each other. It's going to take all of us to get us out of this. So even though there's a lot of negative that we could focus on, there's also a lot of positive that we could focus on as well.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about the challenges and hopes Portland faces in the coming year. One of the things that is so apparent to all of us living in Portland, but I understand, though I haven't traveled too much out of the state in the last 2 years, but it's endemic in almost every city in the country, is houselessness. And I was just thinking, as you were talking about all the mutual aid, that every day when I drive down or walk down Milwaukee Avenue past the north entrance to Oaks Bottom, there's this large homeless encampment that's there. And it's very painful to watch. I mean, parts of it are very nice and tidy, but the part that's like the furthest north of this camp is like just full of garbage, which to me is an indication of a city failure. Obviously the people that are living in those tents have some dysfunction, but the city should be there. They should at least have a garbage can set up for it. There's a porta potty, why not a garbage can? And I wonder how you think that the fact that houselessness is just in the face of just about every well-off, privileged Portlander might start to make a difference.
I don't disagree. I mean, I continue to work with my colleagues to say what we need is a global approach to picking up the garbage. We've actually sometimes put dumpsters out to make it easier for houseless people to clean up their camps. But here's what we find. If we put a dumpster out overnight, people who are housed will come and fill up the dumpster with stuff that they don't want to take to the dump themselves, right? And so we do have to find a way. One thing that I'm working on with the Office of Civic and Community Life is hiring small trucks, right? Small haul trucks, and assigning them a geographic area where they just go 2-3 days a week. They're responsible for keeping that area just clear of clutter, right? I can tell you that houseless people don't want that garbage near them any more than anybody else. When I talk to people in the houseless camps near me and ask them, how can I be helpful? The very first thing they normally ask for is garbage bags, right? And so it's, you know, no one wants to see that garbage. But the city of Portland has never had a public works department, right? I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. So in our city, you had these big city garbage trucks that came around, and their job was wherever they saw garbage, they would clean it up and keep moving. We invest a lot of money in garbage removal and graffiti removal, which I think we shouldn't be investing money in graffiti removal until everyone can afford to live in the city of Portland. But the reality is we invest it in very specific areas of the city. And it's as if we don't see it, it doesn't exist. So if we can keep one area pretty, then we can pretend that we don't have a housing crisis. The issue in the city of Portland is there's not one zip code in the city of Portland where Black people are not cost burdened. And cost burden means that you're spending more than 30% of your income on housing. There's not one zip code in the city of Portland where a young white family can afford to buy a house. The reality is the median family income in the city of Portland right now is around $85,000. And so when we hear people say they're building affordable housing at 80% of median family income, they're building housing for people that make $70,000 a year. So unless we're building housing at 30 to 60% of median family income, we're not impacting people who are working for $15 an hour. Whether it's two or three $15 an hour jobs, they cannot afford to live in the city of Portland. So that's number one problem. And number two problem is we will not be able to build housing fast enough that people can afford to live in. And so unless we are creative and we're trying a multitude of options, we are just not going to be successful in providing enough housing at a rate that people can sustain. And that's one of the biggest challenges. We need big ideas. We missed the opportunity to own Concordia University. I'm still mad about that because I thought, man, it's in foreclosure. City will go down or the county will go down or the joint office and we'll compete to own Concordia University. Even if we don't have a plan for it today, it has everything we need to provide services for our most vulnerable community members. Why would we not take advantage of that? We didn't even try. And so therefore, Concordia went back to the trustees who lost it in bankruptcy for a mere $3 million.
Well, you know, that reminds me of another lost opportunity and makes me wonder about the way the city functions. But a number of years ago when Sam Adams was mayor, he wanted to take the Selvie Island Bridge, which was being replaced with the most seismically safe bridge in the region, and he wanted to put it across the I-205 freeway where Flanders Street is and have it be a pedestrian and bicycle bridge. Interestingly, it was shot down, too expensive, a waste of money, and he was shot down by all kinds of corners of the city. Well, now there's this pedestrian bridge that was they're just finishing putting up across 405 along Flanders Street. It looks an awful lot like the old Selvie Island Bridge. And I look at that and think, how much did that cost? And how much money would we have saved if Sam Adams' plan had gone through?
And that's the kind of big, honestly, this is what brings me excitement moving forward. In the next couple of years, we have billions of dollars in transportation dollars that will be coming through the Portland metro area. And as the commissioner in charge of PBOT, I am so excited at the potential for us to really build multimodal transportation options to actually make sure that we're funding the kind of street improvements that give people options for how they move around. One of my big commitments is creating more car-free areas where people can walk, bike, convene. And we have some of those in the city now, but I'm really excited about expanding those citywide. I think every community deserves a community meeting space that's just about the community coming together. Maybe there's arts, maybe there's music, and every community gets to decide kind of how that community space operates. So with the billions that are coming down in transportation improvements, I'm very excited about the potential for us to actually start building towards a more climate resistant and a multi-transit mode of operating than we've ever had the opportunity to do before.
Joanne, I want to address you now as the Portland Bureau of Transportation Commissioner, because there's two really gnarly issues that I think are facing you. And actually, one of them I covered on the show last week with Robert Liberty, which is, it's called now the Interstate Bridge Replacement Project, which is really the same as the Columbia River Crossing that was defeated several years ago. And then the other one is a place that you've also, I know, raised a voice about, which is the expansion proposed for the I-5 freeway through the Rose Quarter. So let's start with, well, they're calling it the bridge replacement. Robert Liberty wants to say it's really about a freeway expansion. And I know that you were critical of it in the beginning. I want to know, what's your position now, and what do you think is the best way to move forward?
Well, let me just say that when the quake comes, the I-5 bridge will fall. And so we must do something to make sure that when the quake comes, because it will come, that the I-5 bridge won't fall. It is not in my mind as of this moment, right? And let me just say, we haven't voted on any plan. I haven't seen any plan. In fact, I've been attending the meetings for the last year. And I feel like we're at a place where we have some real basic agreements. And the basic agreements for me start with sharing a funding mechanism, not bonding ourselves into just freeway funding, right? Right now, when we do highway projects, the bonding is all about repaying that bond for the freeway development and repairing and maintenance for that freeway, right? Until we decouple transportation from freeways and the funding mechanism, we will not get the kind of transportation infrastructure that we need. So for me, that is a high priority, is to make sure that I keep my eye on what's paying for what, because everything is about how do we build on for the future, and we can't do that unless we have the funding mechanism in place. And so having said that, for me, the other kind of deal breaker, if you will, is really around how do we make sure we're moving mass numbers of people in some very speedy way across the I-5 bridge, whether that is by rail or whether it's by high-speed bus. But it must go from Portland to downtown Vancouver, whatever that it is. And the transit companies, I will say TriMet and C-Tran, are really in sync about figuring out how we make that work. Because, you know, earlier I heard actually it was whatever would happen would like kind of stop at the edge of the bridge, which would be insanity, right? And I can say that the elected leaders that I've had the privilege of working with on the Vancouver side, we really are in alignment as far as our values around both climate mitigation and multimodal transportation options for people. We know the priority must be moving people and goods. But we want to also, and let me just say, on my side of the river, we want to reduce vehicle miles traveled, right? We don't want a whole lot of vehicles on the road because it does not do anything to help our climate at all. So, so that's our goal. And I will say that clearly, that's not necessarily Vancouver's goal, but that is certainly the goal on this side. So, you know, we're talking, we're moving forward. We will be voting on something soon. But I have confidence that we will be, if it's a plan for me, that I will support and that PBOT will help with permitting, it will have the characteristics that I've just mentioned.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of conflicting values and viewpoints. And it reminds me a lot of the struggle that started over, 15 years ago with the original Columbia River Crossing plan. One of them has to do with light rail. And what Robert told me is that they're taking light rail kind of off the table. It's sort of not going to be firmly entrenched in the plan that's currently being put forward. And that makes it different from the original Columbia River Crossing plan, which that was one of the things that sunk the plan over on the Washington side, was light rail and tolling. Well, light rail's off the table. Tolling is still on the table. How do you see that this is different from the original plan?
Actually, I have no information that says light rail is off the table. And with all due respect to Robert Liberle's long history on this issue, I'm actually at the meetings. I'm reading the data. I'm talking to the consultants. And there's been no decision at all that light rail is off the table. So I want to be really clear about that. And so the second part of that question was?
It has to do with the tolling.
Tolling. Let me just say, I'm really appalled that ODOT continues to interchange tolling and congestion pricing, because in my mind, congestion pricing is radically different than tolling. As someone who grew up on the East Coast, tolling means that you're going to pay a toll, and the toll actually repays for building whatever a freeway you're crossing. And it never, ever goes away. It is a part of your life for the rest of your existence.
Except for the Connecticut Turnpike was one difference there, actually. It's the only toll I ever know that went away.
There's only one that's ever gone away, right? And so having said that, congestion pricing to me is really about how do you charge the full value of automobile use during the times where people are prone to use it most? And how do you do it in a way that doesn't actually detrimentally impact folks who've been pushed out to the edges of the city due to the high cost of housing, right? And in my mind, that means that you exempt people at a certain socioeconomic level, and then you actually charge more at high peak hours, and then you charge less different other times of the day. And so with ODOT, unfortunately, they interchange the two, and they continue to say publicly and in documents that they're the same. And again, they're not the same. And so I continue to talk about congestion pricing. And in fact, Vancouver doesn't like the term congestion pricing. And so, you know, people have different names for and it's like, I don't really care what we call it. But I do want to make sure that we're not burdening people who've been pushed to the edges of our city, A. And I do want to make sure that we are charging a higher cost for driving an automobile vehicle and increasing the emissions during high peak time, right? And three, I definitely want to make sure that there is a high capacity people moving vehicle that is it has to be a part of this whole process.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland. Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM. KMUN and KCBB in Astoria. KCEI in Taos, New Mexico. Radio Free Moscow in Idaho. And Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about the challenges and hopes Portland faces in the coming year. Well, before we leave the new Columbia River Crossing project, I wanted to talk about a couple other issues that Robert raised, which are the same problems he sees that were in the original plan to build the new bridge across the Columbia River. And one is the width of the freeway, and that it's going to involve widening that's much more extensive than just making a wider bridge. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. Are you seeing that as in the same light he is?
So there was an article last year sometime about like all this extra lane that ODOT was proposing that was just like emergency lanes that looked like extra lanes of freeway that would just be postponed to a later time. I have seen, again, no plans that actually include that excessive expansion of freeway width. And I would not be supporting something that looked like it was for future freeway expansion. I mean, and I think the reality is that once people see the reduced need, once there are other options that people have to get across the bridge, there are a lot of people that live in Portland and work in the Vancouver, Washington area and vice versa, right? So I think once, you know, change is always hard, but I think people will get out of their cars when they have more options available for them. And so that's what this is about. It's investing in both our climate and really the future we say we want to build. We have to have high speed, and we don't need a lot of auxiliary lanes for any reason.
What's your thought about instituting a ferry service between Vancouver and Portland? I was in a discussion yesterday with the people that are working on the Frog Ferry. to me, that's kind of like my fantasy. I would love to go to Vancouver by boat.
Yeah, as would I, and as would people who could afford it to do so. I think it's a great idea. I hope some private company actually makes it happen.
What they're concerned about actually is that they don't want it to be private. They want it to be a public-private venture, because if it's private, it'll just be people who can afford it. It might not run frequently enough to actually service people. So their concern is that there was originally buy-in from Parks and from TriMet, and now it seems like both those agencies are kind of opposed to the ferry.
Well, I don't know why Parks would want a ferry, because they have no waterway access. And I will say that Fog Ferry, I met 3 years ago. They had a private nonprofit that they developed to actually see if, in fact, this is a viable option. Honestly, we have one of the most underutilized riverfronts. I was having this conversation. Have you seen Vancouver's? Vancouver's riverfront is absolutely beautiful. Have you seen Portland's? Not so much, right? And so we have, as a city, not looked at our waterfront as an opportunity to bring Portlanders to the river for access. I've been talking to the Human Access Project. You know, they worked their heart out for free, actually creating opportunity for people with mobility issues to have access to the water. So there are a lot of efforts taking place. One has no more priority than the other. And I continue to be supportive. We supported their application to the federal government. But I am not going to prematurely commit any public resources to anything that hasn't actually proven itself through the pilot project that it currently is working under. So let's hope they get the contract, they get to come back with some good information. But let's also hope that we as a city start thinking about our waterfront as a meeting space and an opportunity for people with not necessarily a lot of resources to be able to gather and really enjoy the city that we're going to build coming out of this pandemic.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about that project is not just focusing on the downtown waterfront in Portland, it's also focusing on St. John's. Cathedral Park would be a possible ferry landing. That's where the Parks Department comes in. And that sounds to me like really a key issue in equity to put more resources into North Portland, into the St. John's area.
Let me just say, Parks is not in my portfolio. You know, that's Commissioner Rubio. And I spent a lot of time talking to Fog Ferry. So Fog Ferry has already been able to advocate with me in my office, and I know where they are, and they know very clearly where I stand. I'm really open to seeing what comes out of the pilot. So let's just wait and see what the pilot presents and what opportunities they identify at the federal level that we can be helpful with them as we move forward. There's a lot of stuff in flux. And so, Barbara, I'm just not, you know, that's where I am at this moment.
Well, I want to talk about another contentious freeway project, which is the proposed expansion of the freeway through the Rose Corridor, where there's the infamous congestion and also the capping of the freeway as a way of, I guess, trying to make up for all the horrible things that have been done to that neighborhood in the past.
So the opportunity to re-knit the Albina community with the Rose Corridor project is one that I think is a generational opportunity to make reparations to a community that has been torn up over and over again by good public works projects, right? But there are issues around the Rose Corridor project that, again, as transportation commissioner, you may remember, Barbara, that Commissioner Udaly actually stepped off the committee that was the executive board of the Rose Corridor project at the same time that the Albina Vision project stepped off that board because they felt like ODOT was not being responsive to what the community concerns and requests were. I made it a point when I inherited the Bureau of Transportation that I would work my way back to the Rose Corridor table. And I thought the way to work my way back is to meet with the Albina Vision Trust, to meet with ODOT, to meet with the consultants that have been hired to lead the project, to attend some of the community stakeholder group meetings that they had, to meet with the principal of Harriet Tubman Middle School And then I was going to circle my way back and say, this is kind of what I need in order for me to come back as a full participant to this table. Just as I was getting to the last piece, I got a call from the governor that she was convening a meeting around the Rose Quarter Project. And the issue was, once again, ODOT had made a decision about a design that they wanted to move forward. And the design they wanted to move forward was not a design that provided the most opportunity to re-knit the Albina community, and quite frankly, would not have done much to actually relieve the congestion that the whole project is supposed to relieve in the first place. So, so we had a couple of meetings with the governor's office in an attempt to come to a agreement around how that project would move forward. The very short version, because we don't have a long time, is that there was an agreement that there was a design, and I'm actually not even remember what it is because it's been a while since I've been in this conversation. But there was a consensus of the Albina Vision Trust, myself, that we could get behind a process that actually created opportunity to cap the top of the freeway. And ODOT, because I believe their goal is just to do highway projects, they did a very strategic job of kind of pitting one part of the community against another part of the community. And I found that extremely disrespectful and disingenuous, right? Because ODOT actually created the problem. ODOT could have just said, the community wants something different and we're going to go with what the community wants. But no, ODOT decided that they would pit a black contractor against the Albina Vision Trust. And so the governor intervened. We came to an agreement that that was acceptable, presented it to the governor. And that was, I believe, back in, it's been a while ago. It's been a while, maybe about 4 or 5 months ago now. And honestly, my commitment was I wanted an intergovernmental agreement that I could hold the governor and ODOT and other folks accountable to as we move forward. Because, you know, not my first rodeo. I know that people say nice things, but unless it's inviting, it's kind of hard to hold them accountable to it. So we are in a process, I hope, of finalizing that IGA. The biggest challenge, of course, is
a governor's... What was the IGA, I mean?
I'm sorry, an intergovernmental agreement. Which would say, you know, these are the agreements between the city of Portland, ODOT, the county, whatever governments are involved in that agreement. My apology, I hate when people use acronyms. And so let me just say, it's challenging to actually get that kind of agreement right now. There's a governor's race taking place, and it's really hard for this governor to commit the next governor to something. But I also am not going to just sign a blank check and just believe ODOT because they actually don't have a history of being trustworthy and actually moving forward things the way that they've agreed that they're going to move them forward. So right now we're kind of in a holding pattern about what happens with the Rose Quarter. But I am adamant if it comes up for a vote with me, the criteria is we must move Harriet Tubman Middle School. We must make sure that we are creating as much billable land as possible. And ODOT must transfer ownership of that land to the city of Portland so that we can work directly with community for a long-term vision of what happens with those caps and how we build on it and who benefits from that. I do not want ODOT involved in that conversation or the governor's office for that matter, other than for their help in us relocating Harriet Tubman Middle School.
Well, I'm of the opinion that ODOT needs a lot of investigation into, because I've been very disturbed by a number of things I've heard about ODOT doing, well, recently, and then, of course, when you look back historically.
Historically, their role has been to go where there's least resistance and where there's least political power. And least political power traditionally lies in low-income communities and communities of color, and that's why our freeways are where they are.
We should talk about something that's not exactly in your purview. You are like in charge of transportation and the fire department. However, you've had a lot to say about the police. And I'm just curious about where you think we've come since the Black Lives Matter protests of almost 2 years ago in terms of policing our police bureau.
You know, what I can tell you is we have come a long way systems wise, right? And systems are not things that people in the general public actually see, right? If you think about the phenomenal changes that we've been able to make, and some intentional and some actually not intentional at all. So for example, intentional, the creation and the expansion of Portland Street Response, ensuring that there is a unarmed response to people in crises, calling 911 for first responder services. Portland Street Response is going to continue to roll out. The next budget that we pass for the city council will have the full rollout citywide invested in that budget, because that has to happen. We just said we're going to hire a civilian training dean for Portland Police Bureau. To me, this is, again, a transformative move, because for the very first time, and I've been asking this question for like 30-some years, but for the very first time, we will have a civilian who will be developing and leading our training, and it will be around what are the skill sets that we want community police officers to have. We will also this year participate in a truth and reconciliation process. I pushed to have this funded in the last budget process. We are still working on the request for proposal, but it will go out before the month is out. And honestly, until we have completed that truth and reconciliation process, we won't be recruiting the kind of community police officers we want to be policing us in the future, right? So there's a lot of positive happening. The Rethink Police Commission has had its second meeting. I will go to their third meeting. They have 18 months to redesign a truly independent, community-led police oversight commission with subpoena power, with a built-in budget, with their own staff, and with their own ability to move policy that makes policing in the city of Portland better. Phenomenal, right? So we have we've changed the law in Salem so that this new police accountability board's decisions will not have to go through another process, right? They will be able to make decisions that will be final. And so we have done, systems-wide, the things that we promised the public that we would do, right, to start moving us towards a more accountable, a more community-driven police force. But we also know police are only one component of community safety. We know that communities are safer when communities know each other, when there are like community gathering spots, like I talked about with PBOT. We've used some real innovation with PBOT to actually eliminate violence in communities as pilot projects. And I'm happy to say that I think Chief Frome has shown himself to be a real intentional leader, and he's the deputy chief now. And so I meet with Chief Lavelle regularly. I meet with Chief Frome regularly. With Chief Frome, he's a lawyer by trade. So his mind thinks differently than most police officers' minds. And so I find that he's really a thoughtful a collaborator and thinking about how do we push police to be where we know police need to be, right? And we have many studies that we're waiting to get information back from, right? Today, we don't know what the appropriate staffing level is for police. So when my colleagues unfortunately just toss out numbers like 200 here or 500 there or 300 there, it is not based on data. And what I can tell you is that today there are 130 funded unfilled positions within Portland Police Bureau. And so I expect the new training dean to actually ask the first question is, well, why do people not want to be Portland police officers? And how do we make it a more attractive, a more respected, and a more collaborative opportunity, right? So most people expect immediate results. And we know that we didn't build these really unjust systems overnight, and we are not going to unbuild them overnight, right? We're going to have to be very thoughtful and intentional, and we'll have to measure our success along the way. And so I feel like we've done a lot, but we've got a lot more we've got to do in order to have the kind of police force that all of us, no matter whether we're housed or unhoused, feel like when we call, they're really there to protect and serve us.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about the challenges and hopes Portland faces in the coming year. Well, we started out talking about equity in terms of houselessness and how it's in our face all the time. I want to end this discussion by looking at the challenges that Portland's facing in truly becoming a city, a land of equity, and learning how to incorporate everybody in the city who has been unincorporated in terms of any kind of power structure in Portland's long history.
What a question, right? And so I'm not quite sure what the question is in that, except I think the question is, where is the hope, right? And I think those of us who've been here for a while, and I've lived here over 30 years, when I came to Portland, Portland was a scrappy town where any night of the week you could go listen to live music, a world-renowned artist, right? Any night of the week, yeah, depending upon what part of town you were in. There were artists everywhere. Living in really cheap spaces and sometimes working and sleeping in the same spaces. If you look around Portland today, we have that shell still. What will it take to get people to stop investing in making people angry and getting them to spend? What if people for Portland had spent their $500,000 actually investing in a building that said, creatives, you have the space free for a year, and let's see what you come up with, right? What would have happened if they'd have said, we're going to fund these three hotels for a year? Let's make sure that there are no families living on a street, right? What would it look like?
Let's talk about who People for Portland is. I did want to get into them. So for people who don't know what this group is, who are they?
So there's an organized effort, downtown business interests, that have hired a left so-called and right so-called spin doctors to rile up the public to be angry against all elected officials and kind of across the board. And they have a really insidious campaign because it was really hard to, it's still hard to figure out what their goals are with their campaign, because they want people to support Portland Street Response. Well, before People for Portland, Portland Street Response was well respected and well supported by Portlanders. In fact, our entire congressional delegation were shocked that my colleagues didn't support the full expansion in May, but that's behind us. People for Portland actually they want people to contact elected leadership at the city, county, state, and tell them that they're not doing their job, right? Why don't you just do your job? And it's like, well, excuse me, you know, most of us have been since March of 2020 really working significantly hard to address all the crises that have come up. But anyway, I think there are three platforms were a Portland Street Response, body-worn cameras, which had already been mandated for the city of Portland by the Department of Justice because of the settlement agreement we continue to be under. And then the third thing, right, more police, right? So these three things are what they are marketing to the public that... But I don't believe the public actually knows that all three of those things, long before People for Portland started organizing, were in the works and were already taking place. So I'm not quite sure what their goal is, except is to make people angry, right? And they have. And so they're organizing like letter writing campaigns to the city council, to the county commission, to legislators, to say basically we're not doing anything, right? We've just given up and we've just turned the city over to anarchists and criminals, and that's simply not true. But the question is why, And so I didn't find out until the disclosure that they had spent $500,000 just in the first quarter. And for context for your listeners, most people don't spend $500,000 in an entire year trying to influence the Portland City Council. So I find it very disturbing that a small group of downtown business interests have hired spin doctors to paint a picture of ineffective elected leadership.
Well, it sounds very insidious to me, too. And it seems like it feels like the right wing post-Trump goal of just undermining faith in government. Is that what you're seeing?
Well, absolutely. And across the board, because, again, it's like if they had some idea, right, then wouldn't you be saying, hey, we got a great idea. Let's work with you. And sort of tie it to what we saw in the Trump government, when the city of Portland found itself with $62 million that we did not anticipate in our fall bump process at the end of last year, there's a reason why we got $62 million. And it wasn't because we miscalculated. It was because some people made a small fortune during COVID. And some corporations, so at like 10%, 10 companies paid 20% of that $62 million, right? We have some companies that did very, very, very well, but most people, right, have been economically devastated or barely hanging on. And that's where most people are. So the people who have made a lot of money that are now spending a lot of money to say that government is ineffective, is it because last year elected leaders were saying Black Lives Matter? You don't hear elected leaders saying Black Lives Matter this year, right? Last year, I got calls from elected leaders all over the state. How can we help? How can we support Black Lives, right? Have you heard it once? Not yet.
Well, what is your hope heading into this new year? I mean, a lot of us are saying, well, we hope it's not another 2020 or worse, a 2021. Do you think that there's a way that faith in government can be restored? And what does government have to do to get that faith?
Well, honestly, yes. I think that for the most part, government has really been phenomenal during the crises after crises after crises. Are there some things government could do better? No question. Are there missed opportunities? No question. I would say to the public, though, is that government and community working together is the only thing that's going to build a more equitable, a more fair, and a much more transparent city. What we have experienced over the last 3 years, over the last 2 years almost, no other elected officials have ever had to deal with, right? We've had a worldwide pandemic. We've had a worldwide racial justice movement. We've had wildfires. We've had severe heat. I mean, the kind of back-to-back-to-back crises. And I don't think we are giving ourselves enough credit to just stop and breathe and say, you know, we did okay. We can do better the next time. This is what we've learned, and this is how we continue to move forward. We need massive housing people can afford to live in, and it's not going to be one building at a time. We need big thinkers. It's my hope that in this new year, after we take some time to heal, that we also take some time to use the best brains we have in the city to think about how do we collectively build a plan that includes all of us recovering from this economic devastation. How do we include a planet? What does that look like? And there's one piece that we didn't talk about that is not the city's responsibility, even the county's response, well, kind of the county, which is the mental health piece. Until we figure out how to have safe places for people who are in severe mental health distress, that we can take them, that until we have enough places for that, we're still going to see a lot of crises on our street, because that's what I experience when I'm on public transit. I see people, I'm like, if I don't know where I can get them help, how does an average person know? Who do you call to get help for this person, right? Portland Street Response will be part of that, but it won't be all of that.
Well, Joanne, it's great to talk to you again. It's been a while. And let's check in a few months. We can look in a few months to see how well we're doing in realizing some of your hopes and goals.
Yes. I just think if we can all just take a deep breath, think about what it takes to heal in this moment, and think about how we all collectively recover. I mean, because that's what it's going to take. And always a pleasure, Barbara. Always insightful. You always take me places I didn't expect to go. But here we are. Have a great day, and I'll look forward to our next conversation.
We've been talking with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you already are a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community radio station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll broadcast an updated version of my documentary, The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG. We'll go out with music by Curtis Mayfield. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID booster, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
Some people mind is in your way. No more tears do we cry. And we have finally dried our eyes. We're moving on up. Moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now. We're moving on up. We're living proof and all's alert that we're two from the good black earth. And we're a winner. And everybody knows it too. We just keep on pushing. Like your leaders tell you to. At last that blessed day has come. And I don't care where you come from. We're all moving on up. Moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on.